This is the First Time Podcast.
It's us talking writing and publishing.
Welcome to our Masters series,
where we interview Australian and international authors at the top of their games.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast.
Masters series. Hello, Catherine.
Hi. This is so weird.
This is really weird.
This is the first in-person record we have done. Have we done one since COVID started?
No.
I don't think so. The library studio.
When did we eat cherries on your in your kitchen?
Yeah. We were celebrating something.
We were. Okay. The end of the season, potentially.
My God, it's so long.
Obviously, people won't be able to hear the difference, but we are in the same room at the beach.
We're at Summers. It's very exciting. We've managed to move into someone else's house for a couple of days.
Mm-hmm. There's dogs and a fire and a beach nearby, which we have both separately walked on. And you have actually been far more productive than me so far.
That's true.
What have you been doing?
I've been working on my middle grade. I've been cutting words. This is the thing about middle grade. It's short. So mine's about 62,000. I've got to cut about 10, 15,000 words. So it's not too hard.
So explain why. You were telling me this is something to do with the pitch of
the middle gradeness. Middle grade seems like a... I thought that was a pretty narrow genre in itself, but it seems, or genre or age group in itself, but it sounds like there's lower middle grade and upper middle grade. Upper middle grade can be a bit longer. Lower middle grade is tighter for words, and there's more books coming out in upper middle grade and perhaps more of a demand for lower. So I'm aiming for lower.
Aiming for lower.
Which
so you
suits
have to cut 15,000 words.
Yeah.
Now, as someone who people might have noticed last week when I was away, I cut 30,000 words from my manuscript, but in chunks.
Yeah, what's
Can you cut chunks or are you chucking?
I'm cutting a couple of threads. There was a grandma that was involved.
Yep.
She's gone.
She's gone.
Sorry, grandma. She's just been kicked off.
Yep.
So there's a few threads like that where I can cut a whole thread, but there's also a lot of shaving. Having read it to my kids, I see where I'm taking three paragraphs when they've done, they got it. Let's get to the next bit.
Okay, so how many words have you cut so far?
6,000.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah. Well, we only got here yesterday.
Yeah.
We've done a bit of fluffing around.
We have. It's true.
We were going to kayak this morning.
We were going to kayak. We didn't. I ran, but I did not kayak. And I realised that I didn't. Else told me. We are here for Else Fitzgerald's launch of Everything Feels Like the End of the World. And she did tell me that where I ran to today was actually not only the military zone, but also the nudist beach.
Oh,
but
which direction?
We'll go there tomorrow. That direction.
Hilarious.
Yeah, but there was no one there.
Yeah.
I did think about jumping in for a swim because I was so hot by that stage because of this stupid running thing that I'm doing.
Tell us about the running. I saw that briefly on.
So I am running my mate, who I run, shuffle, walk with.
This is what I do. We call interval training.
Yes. She said, let's do this thing to raise money for the Fred Hollows Foundation, which is such a good foundation. It's so good because so much of their money goes to people. Like, they have really, really small overheads. I think that's always been why they're such a good charity. So I have said that I'm going to run 100 kilometres in the month of August, which is only like 3.33 a day.
Yeah, doable.
It's doable. But for a non-runner, it means that I'm doing 3 10-minute runs, you know, with 2-minute breaks in between. So I've shifted, like lengthened the interval that I'm running for.
Yeah.
It hurts.
Those things sound easy, but then if you miss a day, you have to catch it up.
Exactly. Like, exactly. Yeah. So I haven't yet missed a day.
It's the 5th.
Thanks for your vote of confidence in me. Do you think that you're going to be able to cut all those words while we're here?
No.
Oh.
No, unfortunately.
Okay.
I think I'm a bit slow. I will get a fair bit of it done. I think the reading to the kids, I've still got a third to read to the kids, so it's worth not touching that.
Yeah.
Getting the rest ready to go, and that will streamline that
interface. And then what happens?
And then I think it gets sent out to people to read. Yeah. Start of a, yeah, I don't know.
Are you going to do it just under your straight name that you publish your adult fiction under?
Yes. I imagine so.
Not add a, like, initial? What's your middle initial?
E. E for Elizabeth. Is that the most common?
Catherine E. Collette. It's got a nice ring to it.
I don't have a middle name.
I don't. Oh. I am middle nameless.
So is Carney. Mm. Yeah.
But I felt very deprived as a child, so I gave my children middle names.
Carney didn't want to give middle names. I said it was mean. Mean. It's like you're frugal with names. I shouldn't tell you that. Anyway.
Okay, so the other things that we're doing here, we mentioned it's Alice Fitzgerald's launch night for her local community, but you can catch her in Melbourne at Readings Carlton on Wednesday the 10th for the launch of Everything Feels Like the End of the World, her debut short story collection, which is amazing, with Ronnie Sullivan. That's on. I'm also running a workshop on Sunday. So this was when I told Adam that, you know, I was away again this weekend. It was very efficient, though, like what we had planned. Yes. Like there was a number of events.
Yeah.
We haven't just run away to write because we also were meant to have an event with the amazing Antipodes Bookshop. But the world we now live in.
Cancelled.
Postponed. We'll call it postponed.
Yep. Actually, we'll say postponed. Put on pause. We've been put on pause.
We've been put on pause.
That's a Housewives reference.
Oh, was it?
Yeah. Very niche. We're not alone in having events.
We are not alone. And we wanted to talk about it actually because we were also at Jesse Cole's launch of Desire on a Wednesday night, and at the drinks afterwards, people were talking about this.
I think the main things people were talking about is book sales are tough.
Yeah.
And no one's coming to events.
And no one's coming to events. Dismal. Exactly. And then there was an amazing article this week that Nigel Featherstone put out. His latest book is called My Heart is a Little Wild Thing. I haven't read it yet, have you?
No.
It's published by Ultimo. I'm looking forward to reading it. And he has got a great article up on the ASA website, and we'll put a link in, that is all about book events in the time of COVID. Did you have time to read it?
I did have time to read it. It's a really good article. I really liked it. Nigel writes so well. It's also talking to that moment of book launches and the anxiety of them that sits alongside that particular celebration, which feels very, I don't know.
I think that was great that it was both that personal thing of him going, I don't really want to have a launch, but then being convinced to do it and really enjoying it. But also he just gives really great advice about dealing with things at the moment. I really liked, he said, you may need to be more flexible than usual. For example, it's possible that you'll have to find a new launcher at the last minute, or you might need to find a new venue, or damn and blast, the whole bloody thing, the event might have to be cancelled. None of this is your fault. So I think that's important for people to recognise as well.
I think he makes a good point too about writing to people individually. I know with the competition I posted on social media and didn't do a lot else, there was a handful of people I wrote to that I had been communicating with on social media already. But a personalised invitation goes a long way.
And it's nice. Does.
You feel very special if someone...
Yeah, I wanted that too. That stat, industry insiders, this is what Nigel says, say that if our use of social media is passive, we'll reach about 3% of our followers if we advertise on socials. And if our use is active, informed and strategic, we may reach up to 8%.
I know.
That's it.
That's tiny, isn't it?
So, yeah, I do think that that newsletter thing, and actually, did you meet Maggie McKellar on Wednesday night?
No.
She's ace. So she is from, I met her in Sarah Centilli's Word Cave, and she writes The Sit Spot, which is a fabulous newsletter. It comes out on Tuesday mornings, and I will put a link in. And she was saying she has been astounded by the growth of her readership of the newsletter.
Right.
And, you know, and that idea that that's really effective then when you do want to say to people, this is how I've got a new book coming out, this is how you can support it.
Yeah. I like newsletters, as has been documented. I haven't signed up to this, but I will
Have you got any new ones?
No. The Whippet is still probably my favourite. Mm. Do you subscribe to the Whippet?
I don't actually subscribe to the Whippet. I went through a really big like inbox clear out and getting rid of everything because there's just so many flags on all the things in here, Catherine.
I don't use it that efficiently. I just have
a long reading list. Yeah. So where do you hold things that you want to read?
I don't.
How do you?
I just sort of try and remember in my head or write. It's extremely inefficient. An example of that is the George Saunders.
He sends out a lot.
He sends out a lot. I don't think I've read one.
Not one?
Maybe one.
Oh, they're good. But I read about one in four, I think.
Yeah. I was actually disappointed, obviously, that this event was cancelled.
Go on.
But, like, we all, because we were going away. Like,
Catherine,
I wanted to learn of the cancellation as late as possible.
Did you tell anyone in your family?
I did eventually. As I arrived here, I told everyone. Is that bad?
No, it's not bad. I think it's great. I think one must get away at times from one's family to do the work. I love that you did that. We also have another thing to mention. Alison Manning, who people might remember if they've been listening to the show from the beginning, we interviewed in season one. Catherine actually...
Oh, my God. Do you remember that? So
I do remember.
Listeners will remember we did an interview with Alison Manning, but originally we did it like it as a... We had a concept that we would be much more kind of live in what the show was at. So we recorded a lot of stuff like, feelings before events, and we were going to clip it all together and do all this, but we never really did that. But one of the things we did do was like a psychology session where I spoke to Alison Manning. Ooh.
And recorded it.
And recorded it and had people listening in the sound booth as I bared my, life's greatest fear.
Like that was really brave. I mean, looking back,
it was pretty intense.
The whole concept was brave.
Fraught, I would say.
not just I think at some point she was
like,
session.
Do you want to stop now? Like maybe you should reel it in a bit. But I pressed on and then goodness. I said, no, I can't release that.
Yeah, that's right. It was an experiment.
It was an experiment. It was, well, that could be a segue into vulnerability. It was very vulnerable, way too vulnerable for me.
Yes.
I listened to a very vulnerable interview this week, which I'm pretty sure you have listened to as well.
Tell me.
How to Fail podcast, Elizabeth Day with Meg Mason.
I love Elizabeth Day. I love hate Meg Mason, as everyone knows.
God. It is, I think you raved about it at the time, but I would say it's one of the most... Definitely the most interesting interviews I've listened to in ages. It stayed with me. I kept thinking about it. I cried at points in the interview. Did you just love it?
Yes.
Did it have that effect on you as well?
I don't think I cried, but I was I was pretty profoundly moved. I think that also Elizabeth Day has the most extraordinary shape for that podcast.
Yes.
And
it's a very clever structure.
It's very clever, and I think it's astonishing how often she gets
gold.
Really, yeah.
Well, this is the thing, though, and I think this would be true of conversations as well on the ABC, is that so Elizabeth Day's structure is it's how to fail, talk about three failures. The person being interviewed has already volunteered the failures.
Yeah.
So you know that they're happy to talk about this deeply personal.
Yeah.
And the other part is she gets people to talk about real failures.
Yeah.
Because Meg Mason will often cite in interviews, or I've heard her speak about writing Sorrow and Bliss, and she was writing a book before that wasn't working.
Yeah. Yeah.
And out of that space of something not working came Sorrow and Bliss. So it's like a failure, but it's a fake failure.
Yeah.
It's like the classic, failure. Master success,
exactly.
Kind of thing. But she talks about one of her failures is a memoir book that she had written. Had you read this book?
No.
She talks about not wanting to name it because she's not proud of it. It only came out in Australia and New Zealand. I had already read it, so I knew the book. It's a series of essays that she was a fairly young mum, and she talks about that as well. But the essays were about motherhood in those early years. And before that, she had written articles for, I don't know, one of the papers. And so she was used to this sort of thing of writing something and then it disappears.
Yeah.
And then she wrote this book and wrote in a similar kind of humorous vein about stuff, but really hurt people in how didn't really think through that these were real people and the book would capture this stuff. And I remember reading it like 2 years ago or something and thinking it is, I mean, it's fine, but it's a bit harsh in moments. But she talks like really honestly about how much she hates this book and how it makes her feel that it's in the, yeah, it's really interesting, very vulnerable.
I might revisit that. People can also, of course, listen to our conversation with Lynn Mason, where she did definitely talk about the failure of that other book, but she's also just great. And she talked a lot about, in our conversation, she talked a lot about not being on social media too, which people might find interesting.
She's, I mean, she's definitely not the character in Sorrow and Bliss, but you can definitely see humour and complexity in her person, how she responds to
Absolutely.
Things.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Oh, it's such a good interview.
We totally segued before had mentioned that the reason we're talking about Alison Manning is she has a survey for you all to do. It's for novelists, short story writers, playwrights, poets, screenwriters. So you're all included. And it's looking at procrastination, understanding the specific emotional tendencies most closely associated with writers' procrastination. I've done it. It took maybe 10 or 12 minutes. We'll put the link in. It's for Alison's university studies. So that's something that you might...
Research,
yes. university studies is not the right word. Another segue, you talking about Meg Mason feeling bad about the people she wrote about is something that I speak to Josh Kemp, who is our featured author today, about in his debut book. Today, our featured book segment is brought to you by UWA Publishing, and we are delighted to be talking to Josh Kemp about his debut novel, Banjoan. Josh Kemp is an author of Australian Gothic fiction. His debut novel was joint winner of the 2021 Dorothy Hewitt Award for an unpublished manuscript. His short stories have been published by Kill Your Darlings, Overland, Seizure, Tincture and Breach. He's previously been shortlisted for the Kill Your Darlings Unpublished Manuscript Award and longlisted for the Fogarty Literary Award. Currently completing his PhD at Edith Cowan University in Bunbury, which I want to ask you about, Josh. He lives in the southwest of WA. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
I read Banjoan poolside in Fiji and it totally spooked me and thrilled me and made me think in all the very best of ways. And I was kind of very antisocial, in fact, while I was reading it. I was trying to describe it to my family who were with me in Fiji and I was like, it's kind of like Wolf Creek meets Trainspotting meets Boy Swallows Universe kind of with nature writing. So I'm not sure if that's a description you've had before, but that's where I kind of came at it. Can you give us the elevator pitch and tell our listeners what Banjoan is about?
Well, first of all, I hope it didn't spoil your holiday because I'm always worried when people read it on holiday because it's very dark material to be reading when you're supposed to be enjoying yourself. So Banjoan's about this true crime writer named Gareth Hoyle, who not a lot of people know has a very serious drug problem. And it's set during not long after lockdown ended in 2020 in the West Australian goldfields, and he basically heads to Kalgoorlie under the pretense of visiting an old friend, but really he just wants to score. And he and this old mate find themselves in a drug house in Cal, and Hoyle finds this seemingly abandoned 10-year-old girl locked in the toilet of this drug house. And this sets off some pretty uncomfortable feelings for him, things he's probably been trying to numb himself to for most of his life. So rather than taking her to police or a hospital or something like that, he decides to take it upon himself to return her to her nearest family, who she says is her father up in Leonora. And so begins, a road trip from hell is the best way to put it.
Yeah, that's right. That's it. The road trip from hell. It really is. There's an incredible amount that sits behind this novel, I'm sure, and of your own experiences particularly. I think I read about your hiking experience in that part of the country. Can you tell us, when did you know you wanted to write this story and how did you begin?
So I have this fascination with breakaway country, which features quite prominently in the novel. I discovered it over 10 years ago. I was near a place called Mount Magnet, and Breakaway Country is this geological formation which is sort of like laterite granite, and it's so old, it's weathered into these strange stone formations. And when you're walking in it, it really does feel like, I think Hoyle even says it at one point, it's like being on the set of a really good science fiction movie. Yeah. It is like being on the surface of another planet, you know. And basically I found out there was more of this breakaway country in the goldfields up around Leonora where the novel is set. And I started planning the trip. And whenever I go out hiking somewhere, I like to read about the history of the area first, particularly the frontier history, because I think it says so much about a place and why that place is like the way it is. And yeah, I just really couldn't believe what I was reading once I started researching. It was, you know, I've read, done a bit of research on frontier history before, but the stuff I was finding was very confronting. And then to do the trip, right, to go and stand in these places that you've read about, that these unbelievable things have happened in, just gave them more of a gravity, a sense of weight. So it was an amazing experience.
What's your process, Josh? Do you, with something like that, are you taking notes, photographs? Are you actually physically writing when you're out there doing that kind of, walking and traveling around on place?
I never did before this novel, but I think there was probably the sheer volume of stuff. I don't write in place. I find it really difficult.
Mm-hmm.
I have to sort of lock myself in a space like this where there's no light and there's no people.
Yeah.
And then I think it's writing from memory mainly. I did take a lot of notes, and most of it was sort of, and most of the notes just found themselves like straight into the prose. Stuff I would see that had a huge impact. I think there's a scene where they're walking down the main Tower Street in Leonora, and there's the Australian flag hanging from one of the buildings, and it's all torn, so it's just the Union Jack. You know, stuff like that. It's just observation and seemed to hit home.
Wow. You were, as I mentioned in your bio, joint winner of the Dorothy Hewett Unpublished Manuscript Prize, and so many of the people that we speak to and so many of our listeners as well, you know, enter those types of prizes in the hope that their manuscript will be picked up. What was that experience like? Was that the first thing you'd entered?
Yeah, it was. It was completely surreal. Banjoman, when I finished the first draft, I just thought, you know, this is just too violent to publishers trade up. I will have to do a lot of editing to, you know. So I sort of put it aside really for a couple of months. And then obviously the Dorothy Hewett Award opened, and I really wasn't expecting much from it. I just thought it is a very strong West Australian setting. The Hewett was open for entries of a longer word count, which was, I think, beyond, I think it was 120 or 130, which was quite unusual.
Mm-hmm.
You know, usually it's capped at 100,000 words. So I just thought, oh, look, perfect word count. It's West Australian. I'll just send it off and see what happens. And, no one was more surprised when I got the call, I can assure you.
In a great review of Banjoman in ABR, Jennifer Mills wrote, "What's interesting about Banjoman is the way it shows the genre developing and diversifying. Unlike some exponents of the outback, Gothic, Kemp is conscious of the political context of his storytelling and works hard to counter its racist tropes, acknowledging Aboriginal ownership of story, contemporary police violence, and even the destruction of Duke and Gorge." Can you tell us a little bit about your love of the Australian Gothic and how you both wrote into it and away from its traditions, I suppose, in this novel? And now I can see, obviously, that's got a lot to do with the kind of work you were doing in your PhD as well, I imagine.
Yeah, definitely. The PhD, I think, really opened my eyes to, I think, the damage writers who look like me have done. Non-Indigenous writers, possibly with, you know, the best of intentions sometimes, just getting it wrong. Mm-hmm. And that's why, you know, with this, I was very conscious of acknowledging whose country I was writing about, but never adopting an Indigenous perspective, because that's not my perspective. I don't see that as my place.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you know, when you're out these places like Kalgoorlie and Leonora, I find it really difficult to see how people aren't aware of political, what's going on in the political context. You know, the issues of land tenure are just there to see. And actually, in the last month or so, we just had a native title claim go through for the people of the Darlot area, which is very close to Leonora, which was a momentous day, and it didn't really get the sort of news coverage it deserved. But yeah, I mean, I think I'm just aware of these. I'm interested in this stuff normally, so I think it just sort of filters through into the writing.
There's a key storyline about writing and writers, which I found really interesting, especially I think for a debut writer, because it feels like that kind of satire or cynical kind of addition that you sometimes find in writers who are further along in the publishing kind of world and are, you know, deciding to kind of take it down as they go. I know there's a character in Jane Harper's The Survivors, a writer who was very amusing and also, you know, very seriously in things like Michelle de Kretz's The Life to Come. So your protagonist, Gareth Hoyle, is a true crime writer who has written a bestseller and in doing so has put some of his friends offside. How and why did this storyline weave its way into the book?
I've become really interested in true crime writing. It's not something I think I would ever do myself, because just in research, when you're researching particularly very difficult subject matter, it has an emotional toll. It takes a toll. But I find I find true crime writers really interesting, that this is their entire process. Mm-hmm. But also it calls into question, I think, ethical responsibilities. And this is, I think, something Banjuan tackles directly. At the end of the day, you're supposed to be objective the entire time. But in a sense, how objective can you truly be? Especially the book Hoyle's written is, he describes it as true crime memoir and all this other stuff. But essentially, he's just writing from what he's seen. And as Clay points out later in the book, you know, he's only seen these people a certain way and depicted them in a certain way. So I'm just fascinated with all of that. I can't say, I don't think I've ever gotten into trouble for writing about a friend or a family member, but I can see how that could happen, right? Like, especially if you've, so much of writing sometimes is subconscious and unknowing. And if you've unconsciously put someone from real life into a book, I could see how they might find that a little upsetting.
Mm. Joshua, always after writing advice on this show, what's the best or potentially worst advice you've been given about writing or that you want to pass on?
I read some advice once, because I think I write gothic and I think there's also elements of horror in my work. The worst advice I've ever been given was, write about what scares you. And if you're scared of like something really silly like clowns, or when I was a kid, I was scared of the Loch Ness Monster, like, and it's in Scotland, and I live in Southwest WA. So that's probably the worst advice I've ever done. I think best advice, I mean, I'd say probably walk more. Walking for me is a huge part of my process. Like, people are really surprised when I say I didn't take any structural notes for the novel. But if you're alone with yourself in that zone I was sometimes 4 to 5 hours, the structure builds up in your mind and it's just there and you don't need to take notes. And it's almost like meditation to a degree, I think. So yeah, walk more. I think it, you know, you don't have to do it in the bush either. You can just sort of do it in town if you want. I do genuinely think it helped.
I love that. Can you recommend a debut book for us, any time or any genre?
That works out perfectly because this morning I started reading The Whispering by Veronica Lando.
Ooh.
Which won the Banjo. I'm only 15 pages in, but I can see why it won the Banjo. It's really great. I will also quickly mention, although I'm not sure if it's his debut novel, it might be Shadow in the Forest by Lee Swinburne. Probably the best nature writing I've read in an Australian novel for, well, as long as I can remember. It's about a conservationist that heads up into the walls of Jerusalem National Park in Tasmania. And this isn't too much of a spoiler. She finds a Tasmanian tiger, basically. And the writing is just, you know, it's one of those novels where, which I don't come across like very often, where you drag the reading out, you slow it down. Like I started sticking, because it's only like 200 pages. I started doing just 5 pages a day because I wanted to stretch it out as long as I could.
That's fantastic. Yeah. A new name. I love it when we get a new name that we haven't had mentioned before and a new book. That is really fantastic. Thank you so much for those recommendations.
I haven't heard of him. He's fantastic. Yeah.
Love it. We will put a link in our show notes and, of course, a link to your debut novel, Josh Kemp, Banjoan, which is fantastic. And as I said, spooked me, thrilled me, made me think. I hope that lots of people come to it and find it anew. Thank you so much for speaking to us, Josh.
Thank you, Kate. That was wonderful. Cheers.
Catherine, you talked about listening to Elizabeth Day, How to Fail. I have a great podcast recommendation.
Great. I'm always up for podcasts.
And I think, did you first introduce me to Song Exploder or was it someone else?
No.
Okay. So this recommendation is for lovers of Song Exploder. They have just released a new miniseries called Book Exploder. It is so good. I've only listened to one episode. They're so short.
Like
20,
short?
Well, 20 minutes. I call that short.
Yeah.
But the first episode is Susan Orlean talking about her latest book, The Library Book, which is about the LA. I haven't read it yet, but I have a copy that our dear friend Vanita lent me. The LA Library and a great fire that happened there. So I think it's nonfiction. It is nonfiction. But the premise of this Book Exploder podcast is to see how a particular passage was written.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, that reminds me of the Good One podcast with the comedy bits where pull it apart. And this came from this.
So the first episode is Susan Orlean. That's the only one that's out at this point, I think. But it's got George Saunders, Carmen Maria Machado. There's so many amazing authors. I'm so looking forward to it. And I loved it yesterday, the episode
I
listened to.
I'm excited
by
that.
That is one that I highly recommend. Reading? What you reading?
Well, in preparation for an interview I'm doing with Kim Scott coming up, I read Taboo, which is his most recent book. It's 2017. So I'm very late to the party. It's such a good book. I found it, if I'm honest, hard to read just because it's got an element of magic surrealism. I guess that's what you'd call it. Plus it's extremely literary. So it's concentrating reading.
Yeah.
And sometimes I wasn't completely sure what was going on. I actually don't say those things necessarily as criticisms. In some ways that was kind of the point. Like it's a great book. I think it really hits its stride, sort of. I don't know. Who am I? Whatever. Anyway, but it centres around Western Australia and the Noongar people that live there and the white people that live there, and sort of talks to, there's a site that is a former site of a massacre, a site of a former massacre. So it's sort of this reconciliation and all these bits and pieces. But I just can't stop thinking about it.
Mm.
It's so interesting on the complexity of kind of, I guess, intergenerational trauma and violence and all of these sorts of things. But he has this vein that feels hopeful and optimistic at the same time. And that's such an art in that, would you call it a genre or in that space?
Yeah.
Like, to be hopeful. Yeah. And I think I just am increasingly attracted to hope in books.
Yeah. I like a bit of hope.
I can find a lot of things not to feel hopeful about. But so I'm excited to talk to him. He's really smart though.
Yeah, he's so smart. And also the writing, my vivid recollection of Taboo, and you know I often say how worried I get that I don't remember things well enough because I read too fast, is it the first scene where the road with the yes. road train? It is the most yes. extraordinary scene. I think I read it
three times.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, yeah. It's like the memory that I have in my head is as though I have seen it on film.
Yes.
Even though
I can see it. It's so cinematic yeah. feeling. And it comes back as well. Yeah. And then you see it in a completely different yeah. light. Like it's such a clever.
So clever. I'm so looking forward to listening
yeah,
to
that. Yeah. He'll be
interview. Great. In opposition to reading hard literary things, when I'm away writing, which I was last week, I take away a massive bunch of books, including like lots of the writing books.
Yeah.
And then I'll take some, potentially some things that I'm nonfiction usually that I'm reading yeah. into about the book. And
I love packing the book bag.
Oh, the book bag is amazing.
It's good.
But then I mostly like to read a compulsive page turning, something that I'm not
interesting. Like yes, having to I got a Maeve think. Binchy.
Yes, exactly. This is your Maeve Binchy thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So I did two things. I took away a book that had been recommended to me, which is Lessons in Chemistry.
Oh, so many people talking about this.
Bonnie Garmus, I think.
I haven't read it.
I think you'd really like yeah, it. Probably. Like I think that you would really enjoy it. She's got the protagonist, Elizabeth Zott, has got some of the same qualities, I reckon, particularly as the helpline, like yeah. in terms of characterization, the cleverness, some of the way the story is framed, the hope, the funny, yeah. all of those things in it. So that was great. And I reckon I read that over two nights, like really quick. Also a really fabulous, fitting because we have the dogs here with us today, a really fabulous dog voice in it.
Oh, cool.
Which was kind of unexpected.
What do you mean? Like, the dog, inside the dog?
Yeah, it's like the dog can't talk, so it's just inside the head of the dog, who's a really key kind of character. Yeah. It's a great book. It's set in the 1950s. Elizabeth Zott is a chemist, a scientist in yeah. chemistry, and she goes on to host this like really popular food show. It's really... Really
I reckon you are about interesting. The third. The universe is telling me to read
it. The universe is probably telling you to read it. The other thing that I did on one of the nights, literally between the hours of 8:30 and 11:45, I checked my watch, is read from start to finish Where the Crawdads Sing.
Oh,
finally.
I've got so many thoughts on it.
Tell me about your thoughts. Have we talked about this before?
It's like... A lot of description of marshland.
There's a lot of description
shoved
of marshland.
Into a terrible romance novel. I am not its biggest fan.
I was not its biggest fan either, but I could not. I did have to read
yes,
to find out
I
what
did
happened.
Have to finish. Yes. So I was not a do not, like a did not finish.
Yeah.
But I think I have ranted on this before because the protagonist is this small, beautiful person who's beautiful. Did I mention she's beautiful and small? And, like, it just is annoying.
Oh, that's so funny.
But I read it.
Yes. Yeah, I had many thoughts and feelings about it when I finished it too. Just that, like, I was kind of annoyed with myself that I had stayed up so late reading it.
That's kind of lovely, though, at the same time. Like, I see Tilly do that now, where yes. she would just be sort
yes.
of
yeah, it was. It was lovely. And I think, too... that one of the things in not going for like high literary stuff when you're away and writing and thinking about your own book is that I was very much concentrating. I'm up to the point in the novel, my novel, where I'm restructuring things and thinking about like how to keep the reader compelled through time and how you do shifts in time and things like that. So there was yep. one part of my brain, which yes. was watching how many years are we shifting between here? What yeah, am I interested in? Why am I still reading despite yes. the fact that there are so many very long descriptions of marshland that aren't, you know, that aren't particularly great?
The other thing that I remember very vividly was the dialogue was terrible. Like,
if we are putting people offside in our
people
general...
love it. You're allowed. You're actually allowed. These are the rules for criticising a book publicly, that you're allowed if it's...
If it sold 5 million,
success,
yeah, it sold like, 5 million copies, and the movie's about to come out.
Yeah,
will you go and see the movie?
No, God, I'd rather, buddy, go bird watching.
Did you end up
no,
going
I
bird
haven't
watching?
Gone, but I'm going to go. I'm excited. That's what I've been doing. I haven't been watching. I don't have any watching recommendations. Oh. I've been doing.
What have you
been doing? No,
your artist's
way. Yes, I've been doing dates. technically I've only done one date. I went to look at Farlap at the museum.
Oh.
And I wandered around there. The best thing about going to a museum by yourself is you don't have to wait for anyone.
If
you've got a slower pace, you can plod along. If you have a faster pace, if something doesn't interest you, you just do exactly what you want to do. It was lovely. And
have you been doing your morning pages?
I've been doing my morning pages religiously. I love them.
Oh my goodness. You're a convert.
And I'm a big fan. And tomorrow I'm going to a hedge maze that's locally. Mm-hmm. I remember reading Carol Shields' Larry's Party, which is like, I looked it up, 1997 book, really good book. The main protagonist does, Larry, funnily enough, is obsessed with hedge mazes, and that's what he does for a living, and he becomes a very accomplished hedge mazist. I think at one point his wife burns half of the, or destroys part of the hedge. Yeah, so I'm going to wander around the maze.
That is so cool. Yeah. I'm so glad that you are doing that. I really enjoyed seeing people's response to,
like,
lots of people had great responses and about the way that they use it and it's the impact great. That it's had as well.
I think what's nice about it is it has this element of discipline in that you get up and you do the 3 pages of writing. But then it has this other element that's enforced kind of, what's that word, flannery or something, where you saunter around the world and just notice things.
Flaneur is the person who does it, I think.
Yeah.
Please do correct us. I was going to say call in and correct us like we have a radio show. Everyone knows that that's my greatest dream. that reminded me of the thing that I want to recommend, another article, which is about the inner life of writers. And I feel like that the artist way is all about like that.
It is.
The creative and fostering the creative and not at all about how to make your social media algorithm better.
Yeah, that's true.
And this article, which we'll put a link to, lands Samantha Chang, who's a US writer who I hadn't read before and didn't know about. It's on LitHub. It's called Writers Protect Your Inner Life. And I'm just going to read this part out because I think it's really relevant. She writes, "We are taught to believe that the publication of a book is the happy ending to a long journey of working and striving. But according to many new authors with whom I have spoken frequently during this process, publishing is only the beginning of the journey of learning to navigate the world as a public writer, which is the opposite of making art. Mm. And it requires learning to protect that inner self from which the art emerged in the first place." And I thought that was so cool. I love that phrase, the public writer. Like,
yeah,
it kind of, it shows that tension that we have that I don't think that we talk about heaps, but we probably don't acknowledge how much we need to make space for it.
Well, even the artist way is a bit, and maybe I'm overinterpreting it, but they talk about going for a walk for 20 minutes, which everyone talks about walking for writing. But I always walk with a podcast. So walking with nothing, like having silence, is sort of a form of that.
Absolutely. I have found, not to talk again about how I'm running 3.3 kilometres every day, but...
On average.
I have found that the times that I haven't got... When I'm either doing it with someone else, and often she runs ahead of me because I'm too slow, but... So I don't have a podcast in, and I do solve so many issues. Like there is random things in my phone where I've like had to give myself a quick audio note to say, oh my gosh, that's that part of the plot. Or I have just, it's really important.
Yeah.
It's really important.
Sometimes those notes don't make sense.
No, they don't at all. But they're kind of like a little code to yourself as well.
Typed. So there's like, it's auto-corrected to Apple or something. So there's sort of no way I can ever decipher.
I love that. The other thing that people responded to us with, I think that actually I got some private messages, so that you wouldn't have necessarily seen them, is people sending me things about Stranger Things, which was so good. Thank you so much to those people who did. So I went full nerd and watched this webinar. It's called Screenwriting Secrets of Netflix with a guy called Daniel Calvisi. And, you know, it was a bit, he was a bit mansplainy. But the reason that I did it is because it has a plot outline of the first, like the pilot of season 1 of Stranger Things. and kind of breaks it down how it's done, and then looks at how a series is done and like the story arcs and story structure. And I find that stuff so interesting. It's like, do you remember, were you in the class? You would have been in the class because we did those classes together where we first like did Michael Haig or. It's like just knowing that language and knowing the sixth act or the three act, and it doesn't necessarily change the way you do things, but it's very validating.
Yeah. Well, you can see, I know a lot of people that go back to the Michael Haig.
Yeah. And go, well, what's the problem?
Exactly. What,
there's something that's not working, and then you put another structure on it or something like that, and you go, oh.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. So that was really cool.
Breakdown like that?
Yes. Yes. Mm. It's like how you like the comedy breakdown too. We're fascinated with the idea of how things are made. That's it. You got anything coming up?
No. Books, burgers and beers.
Oh, when are you doing that?
I think I do that in about 2 weeks. We're going to do Remains of the Day, but I half want to say I'll do a Maeve Binchy. I think we should do more commercial pop fiction. I don't know if you call her pop. But we'll
maybe
see.
We should maybe we should do a book club. A book club with Maeve Binchy.
That would be fun.
Like all read it at the same time, like how Kate Evans and co do that sometimes. I have got on Monday night, people might be interested, Bronwyn Birdsall, whose new book is called Time and Tide in Sarajevo. She did the most amazing reel recently.
You mentioned this reel. I haven't seen it.
Yeah, well, you need to look at it. But don't worry, we're going to be breaking it down in detail. We're going to do an Instagram Live.
Oh, amazing.
On the day that this comes out, Monday, the 8th. At 7 p.m, I'll put the details up, and I am going to ask her all the things about how she made it, what she discovered, because her other life, other than the writing life, is at like as a marketing digital strategist. Yeah. So she has got, I feel like it's going to be like Shay and Bring the Salad.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
It's going to be that
good
kind of
thing. I want to see that.
Yeah. So we'll be doing that.
So does that save then in the feed?
It does.
Yeah.
It does. We can just.
That's great.
We can just look back on it.
Watch it any time.
And the other thing that people, I imagine, are doing is purchasing their Melbourne Writers Festival tickets. Have you purchased anything yet?
No.
I really want to see Sarah Moss. I love Sarah Moss
so
much.
Is she the Handmaid's Tale actress?
No.
Who's that?
No. Oh, what is her name?
Her surname's Moss. Maybe that's Elizabeth Moss.
Elizabeth Moss, that's right.
Yep.
Sarah Moss wrote, the first one that I read is called Ghost Wall, and it is amazing. UK...
Yeah, right.
Literary writer. She's so good. So she's coming out. She's going to be here in the flesh, as is Sarah Winman going to be here in the flesh. I'm doing two events, one with Michelle de Kretzer and one with Elle Fitzgerald.
Amazing.
So they're up, but I am going to get my tickets for everything else too. There's some
That's
good stuff.
That's amazing. Mm. I didn't know about any of that.
Yeah, well, this is why we talk.
What a time to be alive.
What a time to be alive. You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.